Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Alongside me is commissioning editor and fellow graphic novel novice, Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, you know cheese, you know foreign words and their correct pronunciation, you know the benefits of postural seating, but until this week, you did not know much about comics.
Every week it's like a run through of my CV.
It is.
It's
that
true
fair?
That I don't know a great deal about graphic novels or comics with an X or any of that really. I could probably prattle on about how much I loved Mouse, and I know a little bit about.
Did you? But would you ever sit
Aileen
down?
Kaminsky.
Would you ever? Who?
Aileen Kaminsky.
Oh yeah. Would you sit down with a graphic novel in the way that you would with a novel?
With Mouse, I certainly did, and then I think possibly the reason I haven't done that I can remember since is. Because I always have other things thrust upon me. If someone were to send me a graphic novel or bring me a graphic novel and say, you have to read this now, then I absolutely would do.
The other thing I wanted to mention was you keep sending me emails because you're getting people on LinkedIn, of all places, that benighted of all social networks, complimenting you on the podcast. And you send me these boastful emails.
Well, no, but they're flattering emails.
For both.
They're not boastful for me.
But people are moved listening to you, to us
apparently
to send you
so.
A message on LinkedIn,
so.
Which is lovely. What should they do instead?
They should leave us reviews on iTunes. I would like to point out that one of the reviews that I got via LinkedIn in the 90s was from a lovely man who said that he trades in rare books and they have a cheese club and they enjoy alfresco cheese. And so we had a chat about cheese.
Alfresco cheese.
Alfresco cheese.
You'd be right. See, this is your CV. you're becoming well known as a fromagier.
I would also point out that alfresco cheese is the most considerate way of enjoying cheese.
That's very true. It's not. I'm not even going to challenge you on that, Thea. I'm going to bow to your knowledge on it. So please do. I think there's algorithmic reasons why it's a good thing also. But if you want to comment on the show, either bother Thea on LinkedIn, because it gets back to me as well. She proudly forwards it on. But please do review us on iTunes. You can also follow this podcast on Twitter at @FBFM_podcast. And if you want to subscribe to the TLS, which you all should be doing, Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. And this week, there is exciting or semi-exciting news. If you are a subscriber, you get free access to our 111-year-old archive. So you can read original work by all of the major literary figures of the 20th century. We've got C.S. Lewis writing about Tolkien, Virginia Woolf grumbling about sex in D.H. Lawrence, Anthony Burgess, Samuel Beckett, Nabokov, and so on. You can also enjoy TLS writers failing to spot classics when they are first published. It's something of a tradition in the early years of the TLS. This is a quote, my favourite quote, I think, ever in the TLS, from a 1908 review of Wind in the Willows. Ordinary life is depicted not very amusingly or searchingly, while as a contribution to natural history, the work is negligible. And I think whatever you might think of The Wind in the Willows, because it has talking moles and badgers and weasels, it is indeed negligible as a work of natural history. But that's what we said in 1908. Coming up on the show this week, we'll be discussing the value of graphic novels under the umbrella heading of How Comics Got Serious. The graphic artist and academic Nicola Streeton has reviewed two exhibitions, one in France about depictions of the Holocaust, the other in London about depictions by and of women. She will be joining us shortly. 80 years ago, Virginia Woolf spoke to the BBC on the subject of craftsmanship. There's 8 minutes and 12 seconds of her voice remaining for us. We shall hear a little bit of it and talk to Emily Copley, who has written about the subject of Woolf the Broadcaster. Her voice is absolutely extraordinary. You want to hear it. And finally, the refugee crisis ebbs in and out of public consciousness, but remains one of the pressing issues of our modern age. Zan van Tulleken has reviewed an important new book on the subject by Alexander Betts and Paul Collier, and will help us consider how soluble this problem really is. The name of the artistic medium comics or comic books carries with it inevitable connotations of frivolity, of a lack of seriousness. If you're interested in depth and range the thinking might go, you read a book. If you want temporary distraction, you read a comic. The prejudice in this area is odd if you go back to first principles. A comic is a combination of two media that are unquestionably respectable, artistic imagery and words. So what claims can be made about comics now? How seriously should we take them? Well, the person to ask is undoubtedly Nicola Streeton, who's both an academic and graphic novelist. She visited two exhibitions for the TLS, Shoa et Bande Dessinée in Paris and The Inking Woman in the Cartoon Museum in London. She joins Thea and me now.
In my mind, I prefer a very loose description of comics. Within comic studies, there are very clear distinctions made. So, for example, a cartoon is one panel, one square, so there's one thing happening. And a comic strip is a series of panels, the boxes. And a graphic novel is a long-form comic. So a comic strip is something that might be in a newspaper or a cartoon, and a graphic novel is something that's developed from that. But personally, I hesitate to distinguish, because I think the way I look at it is also about the style, and there's a particular aesthetic to the drawings of both cartoons and comics that is shared, and it's about a certain language that is also drawn on in the cartoon form. So it's reducing something down to a very simple form that creates a symbolism that is immediately recognized. So, for example, this is a weird example that comes to mind maybe, but you know how we recognize in the Western world, certainly, the symbols of a male and female toilets immediately.
Yep.
So it's that kind of idea that's the language, visual language, and then the text works with it, so that within a panel, within a box, you can have two messages which are seemingly very opposed. And that's what differentiates the comic form to something like illustration, where in illustration, the image is simply visualizing what the text is saying.
Can that be a bit forbidding? I just wonder whether there's a certain feeling to someone like me who's not that familiar with comics, it feels it's almost a bit clubby. There's a certain idiom you have to learn, a certain way of reading that you've got to accustom yourself to, and it can feel a bit forbidding to outsiders. Is that fair at all, do you think?
Well, I'm smiling as you say that, and I'm also really happy you say that, because yes, in a good sense, there's a club that all us comics people are bonded together, because it is officially a low form. So historically, it hasn't had the respect of higher. But on the other hand, as comics studies has grown, there is this sort of complicating of, let's introduce some incredibly difficult jargon to make it seem like it's something. But I that's why I began this by saying, in my view, it, you can combine them all. I prefer to be able to say cartoon or comics and interchange the two, or say it's all comics. And certainly there are people who really don't like the term graphic novel, because it's trying to make a low form into something higher and elevate it as a form. And they, you know, one argument is, well, the beauty of the form is its democracy, its ephemerality, and its lightheartedness.
Another aspect of the clubbiness that you were talking about is the use that comics have traditionally been put to, in terms of they tend to cohere around groups that are fighting for a particular thing. So I'm thinking of say the comics with an X, which you write about in your piece.
Well, just explain, what are the comics with an X?
Well, in the 60s in America, part of the underground press was comics with an X, which were comics that were subverting the form, in a sense that they started to deal with more complex subject, so politics, which was the atmosphere of the late 60s, and a lot of it was also around drugs and sex and rock and roll, hence the X was X-rated. So it was bringing the comics form that had been dominated by being for children for 70 years back to an adult audience and an adult readership. So that's what the comics were. And so from that, as you were saying, that there's this clubbiness of it became a political something of a political, possibly tool.
And the political edge of that, obviously, we trace back to, as you do in your piece, the connection between comics and the Holocaust, representations of the Holocaust.
Yes. And actually, I thought you were going to say also before that it goes back to, you know, William Hogarth and cartoonists like that. So there's also that deeper history of political satire.
Well, you went to see this exhibition, Shoah Bande Dessinée, which is about the Holocaust and how it could be represented in the medium of comics. What did you learn from that? Is there a thesis behind the exhibition?
Oh, there's probably several theses behind the exhibition. And it was fascinating and fascinating to talk to the curator, one of the curators who took me around. So it's really what their aim was, the aim of the curators was to say that although for some decades after the war, Second World War, there were stories of the Holocaust and the camps were told in comics and superhero comics, there wasn't any reference to it being a Jewish Holocaust. It wasn't the specificness of Jewishness was removed from the stories. So although they were about the camps, it wasn't evident that it was Jewish victims,
which was really interesting. Why was that?
Well, so there were several reasons, but so one of them was that during the war there was still a need to call men to service, so that by presenting the true horror of it and what it was about would put people off because it's, you know, it's about death and torture and so on, and horror, so that characters like Captain America were about represented heroism and chivalry and war is this great thing for young men to join up, something like that. So, and that's also explains why the comics form was very male and had a very male feel to it, and lots of the stories for quite some time after the war as well is this celebrating the heroism of the people who went to war and lost their lives. So that was one aspect. And there was also, I think it was a specific to the politics of France after the war as well, that a lot of the population of France had actually been, you know, in alliance with the Nazis or supported. So there was that element.
So they didn't want it sort of re-presented back to them.
Yeah.
Tell us about Mouse by Art Spiegelman, because I suppose when we were talking about this in the office and we said, oh, there's this Holocaust exhibition, virtually everyone I mentioned that to said, oh, Mouse by Art Spiegelman is the thing they've initially thought of.
Yes, it's fascinating. And again, Pastor Monique said that the curator, the way they've presented, laid out the exhibition is in effect it's pre-Mouse and post-Mouse. So there was all this rise of the superhero comic and building America up to be great. And then there's the sort of reality that started coming out in the 70s. And by the way, to go back to the comics, the underground movement, that was where Art Spiegelman came from. He was a trained artist and his interest in comics was more from the what we call alternative or counterculture. So in the 1970s, he had been drawing this more autobiographical story based on his parents' experience of the Holocaust and surviving the Holocaust. So that became a very new way of using comics to tell this very serious story. And it's been an immense impact on comics as we know it. And myself as a cartoonist like you, it was the first graphic novel that I came into contact with and thought, oh, this isn't comics in the stereotypical way of superheroes or Mickey Mouse. It's something much more challenging and innovative. So I mean, the innovation is, of course, that he used animals to tell the story, and he portrayed the Jews as mice, the Nazis as cats, and the Poles as dogs. Sometimes I forget the way around. But anyway, this was at the time.
Yeah, I think it's the Americans as dogs and the Poles as pigs. Is that right?
Well done, you got it. Okay. Yeah, so he'd been developing this in a serializing it, and then when he collected the volume together and approached publishers to have it published, there was this real fear of taking it on because of the risk of trivializing something, a subject matter so serious. But then when it he did find a publisher, it became an instant overnight success and bestseller, and still is, and won the Pulitzer Prize. So the legacy of that is that publishers are more open to autobiographical stories, often around trauma and more serious subject matter. And since then, that was 86 and 92, his book was published from memory. And then, although it was available, you know, known about since the late 70s, and since then there's been this change in how we understand the comics form can be used, the applications of it.
And you write about it in terms of trauma. What is it about the form that makes it so suited to depicting and working through that?
Well, one of the ideas that's been written about is the idea of repetition. So that if it's, for example, an autobiography, and most people working in this graphic novel autobiographical tradition, which is also different to mainstream comics, by which I mean superhero and the funnies, most people in this world are the writer and the drawer. So we're doing everything. And one of the things that you do when you're drawing a story of yourself is you're constantly drawing yourself. So every panel, you're representing yourself. And there's something about reliving. There's a theory that talks about the reliving of the trauma. So it's going based on Freudian ideas of trauma and catharsis. So it's related to that. So that might be why it's successful. Although it also might be that explains the author why it's successful, but perhaps it explains for the reader as why it's successful for the reader as well. But it's also as a book on a specific trauma. For example, if you take a graphic novel about the experience of cancer, for example, and you are yourself, you've been diagnosed with cancer and you're in a state of shock, to read about it in prose form might be very tiring. Whereas something like a graphic novel, you can read it in an hour. So it is a simple form, and it's the simplicity that actually is its strength in this case. So you can digest something, and it because of the immediacy of the symbolism and the impact, you can get the message very quickly.
But just finally, you get to see this exhibition, The Inking Woman, and you said that the comic book in America, you know, Captain America superheroes were very, very male. Yeah. And I think that's been true almost the entirety of the history of the superhero narrative. What's the story that's told in that exhibition of female cartoonists and comic artists?
Well, I've noticed is that feminists used the cartoon form from the 70s, so in Britain certainly, so that magazines that appeared to promote feminism, such as Spare Rib, Trouble and Strife and so on, and Feminist Review, as it became an academic subject with women's studies, and in every single issue from the beginning of Spare Rib, they carried these funny cartoons. And again, that's why it is predominantly cartoons. And from the 70s onwards, there's been this ongoing development of women cartoonists working away, but parallel really to the mainstream comics platforms. You know, even now in mainstream comics, it's not obvious. There are women, but it's not a women's platform. And yet something like the graphic novel has, the women have been coming along, and finally it feels like there's an acceptance within this form because it's combining literature with comics.
Can you give us, just to end on, can you give us a few suggestions of where we might start, who we should go and look up?
Yes, Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis is a fantastic graphic novel.
Yeah. It became a film, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and the film, and that's great too, hand animated. But in Britain, one that's just come out is Paula Knight's The Facts of Life, which is addressing issues of infertility and multiple miscarriages. And Una's Becoming Unbecoming is another interesting graphic novel that came out last year about slut-shaming set against the background of Peter Sutcliffe's attacks in Yorkshire. So it's again, it's historical, but also based on personal experience.
Persepolis particularly, I thought the film was great.
Yeah.
So if people haven't seen that, but that's three things for us to go and look at. Nicola, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's interesting, isn't it, how in her piece Nicola points out how successful the Comics Unmasked exhibition at the British Library was a few years ago, and again how successful this one in France has been. It really gives you a sense of the appetite is really there. People are really drawn to these exhibitions.
I think that's right. I think because there's something in the culture clash between cartoons and the Holocaust, which probably has a sense to people that there must be something real happening, because it's a very simplistic, childish almost medium at one level, and then it's the sort of the most difficult and large subject almost that exists, and the two being brought together, I can see why that would intrigue people.
Yeah, I can't. I wonder as well if it's got something to do with, because it's such a deceptively gentle form.
Yeah.
Whether people then feel like they're not being bullied in any way to feel any particular way or think along a certain line. It's much more allowing of your own impressions.
That's very interesting. Should we have cartoons in the TLS there?
Possibly, if the right person comes along.
Well, that's the thing. I'm kind of, you know, they exist in the New Yorker and they exist in some other places. And something that's funny and quick and...
Is this a recruitment drive?
Well, yeah, actually, I tell you, if you are a cartoonist listening, send me an email, contact me on Twitter, at Stig Abel. And yeah, the last year I've been mulling it over. I think the difficulty is finding the right number of people who are capable of producing the right number of cartoons, because once you do it, you've got to do it forever, and you need a stock of them. But I'd love the TLS to have one or two cartoons that just made you think or made you laugh. I just don't quite know how to get the supply going.
Mm. Well, as you know, my skills are limited to octopuses.
You are very good.
Octopi?
I don't think it is octopi.
It's octopuses.
Yeah, it's octopuses, and I have seen that drawing. In fact, almost in my first week, someone's at all Thea, you know, she's good at drawing. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, she drew an amazing octopus. And then did they even find it? I've got a mental picture of the octopus that you draw. Have you drawn anything else?
When I left the TLS briefly.
The first time.
Terrible mistake, yeah, obviously. Dreadful. And my leaving party, you know, as is the tradition, you do a mock-up of a front page.
I did, indeed.
But that's where it featured. I can't remember why I'd drawn it.
What was the headline?
All. Can't remember.
Oh. Well, you're back now, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that was a non-story, but okay, that's where it came from.
You're artistic and you think we should do cartoons, is the conclusion we'll draw from that. Well, that's worth doing. The refugee crisis is a paradox, ever present and yet often ignored, something that excites pity but also seems to rouse anger, a state of affairs that is sometimes seen as a cause of grief, sometimes as a consequence. We're arguably seeing one of the greatest mass movements of people in human history. Certainly we know that there are 65 million uprooted people in the world, and 20 million of them are refugees, the highest since the Second World War. Oxford rock star professors Alexander Betts and Paul Collier have written a book entitled Refuge, Transforming a Broken Refugee System, that seeks to provide a solution to this seemingly intractable problem. It's been reviewed this week for us by Alexander Van Tulleken, who has an unlikely CV, which includes being a doctor, an expert in humanitarian aid, a dietary guru, and a children's TV presenter, among other things. He's like a benevolent, intelligent version of George Osborne when it comes to wearing multiple hats. He joins Thea and me now. Zan, let's start with the problem, and then we should probably move to the solution. Is there a common and accepted set of causes for the refugee crisis?
I think this book covers that really well. I think the category of who are refugees, who are migrants, and how we should describe and define those people is really up for grabs. And there is a whole field of study called migration studies that seeks to ask in detail what makes people move. But basically, yes, this book describes very beautifully how the chaos in Europe kicked off, what happened in the Arab Spring, and how that drove more people to Europe, and how, if you like, that snowballed, how it became a sort of vicious circle of the more people that went to Europe, the more doors that got opened, and the more doors that got opened, the more people came, until the system collapses and the Schengen system gets shut down. People stop being allowed to move. Germany changes the rules again. And so we now have a big sort of die-off in the number of people coming. And I think that is the main strength of this book. I've traveled through Europe trying to meet refugees and understand it. And up close, you literally cannot see, well, I shouldn't say literally, but it almost feels that you cannot see the wood for the trees. In fact, this book tidies that up very nicely. It's a very, very hard set of questions to answer.
Is the problem that we almost look at the output? We look at someone who's walking through the streets of Germany or on a beach in Greece, whereas the question occurs in the Middle East itself, that we need to find the political answers to the original causes rather than the symptoms, which is the refugees arriving actually in Europe.
I think so. And it's also very hard to understand why any individual person leaves their place. We want a lovely, simple narrative to say, look, this person left Syria because there's a war. In reality, they left Syria because they couldn't make any money, because their business had been bombed, and because they heard that there was a better opportunity to work. And frequently, when they arrive in Germany and find out that what the human traffickers promised them is a lie, they aren't going to get a house, a car, and 5,000 euros a month, they turn around and go home. And so that status of fleeing persecution is probably not quite right. They're probably just fleeing danger, and they're also fleeing poverty, or at least the increasing risk of extreme poverty, or the risk of danger. And so it's a very, very muddled, we want to impose a clear narrative. And in fact, even the people themselves struggle to articulate what is going on.
And does it make it less, I mean, that seems to be the intriguing question. Are we less morally obliged to help someone who is leaving Syria because their life is so unutterably awful, they want to find a better way of existence? Now, that might make them a refugee in one sense, but it also, there's a grey area between that and being someone who's just seeking a better economic existence. So they're economic migrants. And are we more morally obliged to help a refugee than an economic migrant?
Well, this is what Collier and Betts take on with a huge amount of clarity, but I'm not sure when you're actually in the situation and dealing with it out of the ivory tower, whether it is that clear. I mean, when you personally stand in a refugee camp and see what it means to put your life on hold and to pause in a camp for 5 or 10 years with your children and deny them education and opportunity, it becomes very hard to sift out what the moral priorities should be. So I guess there's a sort of fairly straightforward moral hierarchy of going, well, we should help people who are being bombed and killed and persecuted because of who they are more than we should just help people who want a better job. But it becomes, at least for me, even that calculation becomes pretty difficult from the privileged position I sit in.
And so, I mean, the whole argument hinges on this close to home approach and these special economic zones, or SEZs. Really, what we're talking about is sort of offshore labour. So, I mean, is that not a slippery slope? What kind of jobs are we talking about? I guess I worry that it's a slippery slope into economic exploitation, really.
I think that's exactly right. And this book is wonderful and optimistic on the one hand, because it says, look, why don't we give refugees jobs? That'd be good for them and good for us. And the best bit is the jobs aren't even going to be in England or Germany. We in the West don't have to really let people in, because it's better for them to stay closer to home. They can get home more easily and the jobs will be more appropriate for them. And yet this is an argument for every anti-immigrant, right-wing, whatever, all that sort of unpleasantness that is raising its head in Europe at the moment. This book is grist to their mill. So I think it's naive in the end. On the one hand, it is fantastic to let refugees work, and it is madness to stop the tens of millions of people who are refugees from being able to work. I mean, those are squandered lives. But the idea that they present an economic opportunity and that this is a solution to the problem, I think misunderstands both what refugees seek to achieve, which is something much better than just working in a special economic zone. And it also misunderstands what these economic zones are going to do.
Well, the whole project was in, I mean, they've implemented one in Jordan, haven't they? There is a version of this. How success, and that's had a year now, how successful has it been in its first year?
Well, so I think, Thea, that is the most wonderful question. And that's what's extraordinary about this book, is these two absolutely stellar professors. I mean, it would be hard to find people with better resumes or who are more well-known in this area. And they have set up an idea which not only can be easily measured eventually, but can kind of be measured now. The Jordanian government was meant to issue 200,000 work permits for refugees. They've issued less than 40,000. Now, 40,000 is a lot. But when the anthropologists start interviewing people, when the NGOs start interviewing people and saying, how well is this scheme working for you? The refugees say, We're worried that it's going to stop us getting permission to move to Europe, because European countries will reasonably say that we've already got a scheme where we've given you a job in Jordan. You don't need to travel any further. They much prefer seasonal work because it gives them an opportunity to move and to earn money in less formal ways. That the informal economy in some ways works well for some refugees. And so even the people who've got to the kind of end product and have a job in the special economic zone don't say, oh my God, my life has been transformed. This is fantastic. The interviews with them tend to be more like, you know, this is okay, but it's still pretty rubbish compared to other opportunities I might have.
So the notion that this is a sort of silver bullet doesn't seem to exist. Let's bring it back to Britain, if we may, Zan, because I'm interested in your views on the British attitude to the crisis, because we are now, slightly surprisingly perhaps, in the middle of an election campaign, which at its heart will have populist calls for the reduction of immigration and foreign aid. And in some ways, foreign aid is as hot an election issue as immigration. People say they don't want to see Britain spending lots of money on foreigners. They want to see Britain spending money on the NHS and the social care crisis. So we are living in a period over the next month where issues around how we consider people coming to this country or people being the beneficiaries of money from this country will be very central, won't they?
Enormously. And I wish that it was possible to give a very clear, simple answer. My personal view, I guess most simply, is that the money we spend as foreign aid has a huge value, both ethically and pragmatically, and we do get benefit from it. But there are unmet needs in the UK, and it isn't unreasonable to say that helping people closer to home makes sense. So I think undermining those arguments is not straightforward at all. We let very few refugees in, and we are not overwhelmed with immigrants we don't need or don't want. They've been a huge boost to the economy. And so whether we're talking about refugees or economic migrants, we don't suffer in either case from either category of person. And so I think most of those arguments are, I think all of those arguments about who we let in are fear-mongering and really not grounded in any fact, none of which has ever stopped those arguments working before. But the foreign aid money is more complicated. Foreign aid money we have not traditionally derived. There have been large numbers of projects which have not given us huge value for money.
Well, it's a UN recommend, and it's one of those things where the more you look into it, you know, the UN recommends 0.7%, I think, of GDP to go on foreign aid. And yet you speak to virtually anyone in government, nobody thinks having an arbitrary target is a sensible way of ensuring foreign aid is well spent. Because what happens is you get near the end of a financial year and you've got a certain amount of money, and so you spend it on whatever project will take the money in the most easily and efficient fashion. So you're not focusing it on, say, building a special economic zone in Jordan, because we think that will deal with the migration and refugee crisis. You might spend it on something in Egypt, which has no benefit to anybody.
As possible, yeah. And that's not uncommon in all sorts of ways. I mean, so I work for an NGO called Doctors of the World. I have been responsible for taking a salary from that foreign aid budget and for raising money on their behalf and on behalf of other organizations. And I guess the reason that I think we should be spending that money on foreign aid is because we are getting better at doing it. And because it compels us as a country, as a government, and as a group of private institutions, NGOs and companies to look outwards and to attempt to solve problems. And I guess that what I like about this book is it is optimistic and it is making a case. And although the case is a bit naive, it's a bit simplistic and it won't get there, an attitude that says spend the money at home, don't care about the foreigners, don't look out into the world, in the end does not do us any good. We benefit from being cosmopolitan and we benefit from attempting to do good in the world. And to believe that you can just do good and do no harm would be to totally misrepresent how the foreign aid system works. But there is a delicate balance there that for me swings in favor of saying almost that it's a gesture that we reach out and try to help people, because to not do so would be appalling. And especially, I mean, Syria now, we do not have a solution to that problem. And if you let everyone in from Syria, that causes huge problems, not at home, but it causes problems for the war in Syria as well. And so none of this is straightforward, but a caring attitude and those kind of gestures, to me, create the kind of world that we want to live in. Not, that is not an argument that will satisfy Paul Collier or Alexander Betts, I don't think.
Well, it's an argument that broadly satisfies me. Zan, thank you.
In that case, mission accomplished.
Mission, exactly. What more can anyone possibly want? Zan, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's lovely to speak to you.
It's interesting that Theresa May, who, possibly because she believes she's going to get the biggest majority ever, has said now in terms she will stick to the 0.7%. She didn't need to, you know, if she was throwing red meat to her traditional supporters, she wouldn't do that. She'd have vacillated a bit on that, but she said the 0.7% is important still.
I suppose sticking to the 0.7% isn't going further. So she's just saying we're going to stay. And most people, I don't know, I mean, she's just making it clear that she's not going to do more than has been done. No, she's not going to do less.
And she has said she'll do it differently. So what will be interesting will be, do you start, and you see this already, do you start spending a bit of that 0.7% on things that are broadly defined as foreign aid, which might be defence in foreign countries?
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that might shift slightly. That would be the bit where she compromises. Because I'm kind of with Zand in the sense that gestures do matter in politics.
Yeah.
And although I think the 0.7% causes administrative problems, and therefore I think being locked to it is possibly causes more problems than it solves.
So
as a gesture, it kind of works.
Would you favour more of a sort of an honesty box approach?
Yeah, I think I'd say that you'd want to prioritise what you're doing. And so you'd almost spend where the priorities are. So instead of saying it'll always be 0.7%, you'd say it will be between 0.5 and 1%. And we will prioritise these 10 areas. And if we, and then you do that and you take the money as far as you believe the money will go. What you have at the minute is just this accountant's manager.
Yeah.
You sort of say, oh God, we've done, you know, we haven't done 12 billion, we've done 10. So what can we spend this 2 billion on? And then they make bad decisions. And I think that's where the problem with foreign aid lies. But as a gesture, I mean, I want to be part of a country that helps other people.
Mm. Yes, you do.
Yes, and you do. You sort of looked shocked at me when I said that. I thought you were about to say, no, you don't. You don't want that at all. I think we all do, exactly.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Are too many books written and published? It's a very contemporary-sounding question, and Stig is nodding now. It is indeed one that literary editors have asked themselves on an almost daily basis, and it's one that Virginia and Leonard Woolf were already arguing about in the late 1920s, before the commercial currents of publishing became as torrential as they now are. We can only imagine the wry and authoritative jabs that the two must have made, because no record of the talk remains. Back then, the BBC didn't record its programmes, helpfully. What we do have, though, is a clip, 8 minutes and 12 seconds long, from another broadcast, one of only three ever made by Woolf, in which Virginia Woolf grapples with the unteachable, mercurial and promiscuous nature of words. The talk was called Craftsmanship, and it aired 80 years ago, more or less to the day, and it was Woolf's last ever broadcast, although nobody, apart perhaps from Woolf, could have known that then. The clip is well known, it's on YouTube and it's got about 500,000 views, but its rather loaded context is not known. We'll run the clip at the end of the show, but here's a snippet to give you a sense of it.
In order to use new words properly, you will have to invent a whole new language, and that, though no doubt we shall come to it, is not at the moment our business. Our business is to see what we can do with the old English language as it is. How can we combine the old words in new orders, so that they survive, and so that they create beauty, so that they tell the truth? That is the question. And the person who could answer that question would deserve whatever crown of glory the world has to offer. Think what it would mean if you could teach, or if you could learn, the art of writing. Why, every book, every newspaper you pick up would tell the truth, or would create beauty.
We're joined on the line now by Emily Copley in Montreal, who's written a commentary on Wolf's broadcast in this week's paper. So, Emily, I'm wondering, this was part of a new BBC series called Words Fail Me, which Wolf was asked to contribute to as a representative of fiction writers. Why did she dislike the proposed title so much?
Yes, she was not the only one invited, let that be said. She was not supposed to be the representative. Aldous Huxley and a few others were invited, but he declined. So she was the representative. The idea of craftsmanship suggested to Wolf that words can be subdued, words can be controlled, that we are in control of words and they will do our bidding and we can define them precisely and use them exactly how we mean and they will do what we say. And partly this is a sort of straw man argument. I mean, if you ask someone, you be the representative of fiction among philologists and lawyers and other people who need words to be very precise, of course Wolf will sort of play up her role as a fiction writer and thus as someone who values words for their associations, for their ambiguities. So partly, you know, her difference with the other speakers is exaggerated. Partly it's genuine that she does not think writing is a craft, as so many people do today. She thinks it is partly inspiration. Certainly it's informed by education and reading. But finally, one has to be very lucky and words have to be very cooperative. You can't just set about to write the brilliant thing.
Before we move on to more of what she said, we've just heard her voice. It is an absolutely extraordinary sounding voice. Some of it's, I think that people speaking on the BBC in the 20s will have had that very BBC RP deliberate voice. Do you think this is her natural voice? Is that how Virginia Woolf would have sounded on a daily basis, do you think?
You're asking me to adjudicate between Quentin Bell and George Ryland. Yes. Well, Quentin Bell thinks that her voice sounds strained, not at all like her. And he is, of course, with her nephew. George Ryland, who was her good friend, and a prompt, in fact, to her speaking on the radio, thought that she sounded very anxious at first, but then she loosened up and became, quote, her very self. I don't know. I would like to think it's her real voice for the reason that it's all we have. It would be nice to think we could expand upon this and imagine how she sounded. On the other hand, it would be nice to think this isn't her real voice because it sounds, indeed, a little haughty to us today, but there's a distance of time, and then I'm American, so I'm not... I probably shouldn't weigh in on that.
Well, I do think there was a thing at the time, which is not entirely irrelevant, which is when you're talking on the BBC in the 20s, I suspect you almost put your Sunday best on.
Well, there was a manual, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Pronunciation guide.
Well, Received Pronunciation, RP is a BBC, and I don't know, it doesn't sound natural to me, but it's an incredibly striking voice still, though, isn't it? I mean, it lingers with you.
It is, and she was very, I'm sure she felt very much that she was performing, that this was a performance, and she hated performance. She hated, I mean, she loved parties and dressing up and on the one hand, sort of thrilled to that, but the element of artificiality and constriction and being on the stage, in a sense, this she didn't like at all, and this extended to actual dramas, actually going to the theater. She was always much more interested in the audience around reacting to what was happening on stage than to the players. Anything that was, performative is the word, what sort of irritated her.
It's a funny thing. I wonder why she accepted the gig in a way, because, like you said, Aldous Huxley didn't, and she became, possibly against her own wishes, the representative of all fiction in this series.
It's interesting in that respect, because the Wolfs were wary of the BBC at the time. Leonard Wolf, I think, warned not long after that it was verging on dictatorship, and clearly wasn't a decision that she took lightly.
Yes, and in fact, he had said that even before the broadcast, yes. But I think she was very persuaded, but because of her friendship with George Rylands. George Rylands was a Cambridge don and an expert on Shakespeare, and when he was in his early 20s, he had worked at the Hogarth Press, and he was very good friends with the Wolfs, and they thought of him as a golden boy and extremely charming and life-giving. These are the words they use. So they really, and his connection was, he introduced them to George Barnes, the producer of the Words Fail Me series, and they had meals together, and it was through George Rylands that George Barnes sort of felt he could write to Wolf and invite her to participate. And indeed, he is so eager to get Wolf on the show that he says, I know your spirit soars outside the four dimensions and cannot be confined to a studio at Broadcasting House. Can I tempt you by suggesting that
Dady, that's Rylands, Dady cross-question you. And I'm quoting. So the idea was that Dady, George Rylands, was very implicated in the invitation, and he and George Barnes so desperately wanted Wolfe to come that they were even willing to say, don't even bother writing a talk, we'll just have an on-air conversation in the event. That's, of course, not what happened. But I think the idea of having a conversation, the idea that this could be a live dialogue, informs what Wolfe ends up writing, which is sort of to turn a monologue into a dialogue. And indeed, she alludes to a talk that Rylands had given before the series, in a different series about Shakespeare, in addition to alluding to speakers in her own series. So she turns what could have been a real conversation into a more deliberate conversation on the page and on the air.
And the concern about the BBC was that it was trying to make moral judgments about writers at the time. So it was trying to exclude people like D.H. Lawrence or James Joyce. And presumably the Wolfes would be very conscious of that, not least because she was writing books that some people would object to themselves.
Yes, exactly. And as I mentioned in my piece, the Wolfes, Leonard and Virginia, both were among 40 writers who signed a letter to the Times denouncing the BBC for their sort of censorship of contemporary fiction. So, and of course, the Wolfes were very sympathetic to Joyce's being censored and Lawrence's. Yes, exactly. All of that is true.
And so what came after her talk? I mean, if I can summarize that the three talks before her argued in favour for a sort of a scientific pinning down of language, and then she opened it up to say, no, we won't master it, it's a mercurial form. What did the speakers that followed her argue for? Did they respond to it? Did they take issue with it in the same way as she had taken issue with the speakers that went before her?
There were four speakers after her. There was Lord Macmillan spoke about legal language, and he said that legal language has to be extremely precise, otherwise we get into a mess. He does not mention Wolfe. Then you have Douglas Woodruff, who spoke on political language, and he is saying, like Wolfe, oh, it's language has all this ambiguity, but unlike Wolfe, he says this is really for the benefit of politicians, that politicians can use a very ambiguous word that doesn't commit them to anything, and so we have to be careful of that. And so he also doesn't mention Wolfe, but what he does, like Wolfe, is emphasize that ambiguity conveys power, that words don't need to always be precise and sort of tamped down, that there is an inherent ambiguity in language. For Wolfe, the power of this ambiguity lies in art and beauty. For Douglas Woodruff, it lies in persuading the masses, or getting elected. Then you have two speakers who do seem to come closer to Wolfe. Leonora Lockhart, the other woman in this series, speaks about basic English, which was an 850-word vocabulary for non-native speakers, and she says that, and she mentions Wolfe by name. She says, in an earlier talk in this series, Virginia Woolf asserted that words are not useful at all because they lead the mind capriciously on from one image to another and will not stay put. The trouble with the plain reader, when confronted with the stuff of literature, is that words as he knows them are useful and quite unexciting. He cannot make them stand on their heads and perform tricks. So Lockhart does engage Wolfe in dialogue in order to say, well, Wolfe is speaking to the sophisticated reader, but I, promoting basic English, am speaking to the plain reader.
So Lockhart believed that that English should be narrowed down to just 850 words,
yes,
as a way of improving understanding.
Yes, well, the understanding, it was primarily for non-native speakers. So improving the understanding of people who didn't have access to the half a million words of the OED. So her audience is very different from that of Wolfe's, although there's a question of who her audience is, in fact, because she says that basic English can translate Joyce for the uninitiated, and she gives an example of a translation of Anna Livia Plurbel. But you think, well, really, who cares what Joyce is writing if they don't know English? Or why are they interested in Joyce but they can't bother to learn, maybe 1,000 words of English?
So. And how can Joyce be Joyce without Joyce's language?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I always think that, but at school, for example, I remember learning Chaucer, and you read a very simplified version of Chaucer next to it. Is it entirely impossible that someone could read Joyce and have an almost a simplified translation running alongside it?
if you're reading for events.
Yeah, if you're reading for school. You know, I think there's translations of Shakespeare even where there's sort of the language. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it is a thing, isn't it, to simplify what otherwise would be very inaccessible texts for people who otherwise would not get access to them.
Yes, it is a thing, and you know, translations of Shakespeare, translations in quotes, are what gives us our word Baudelaireized. It was Baudelaire who made Shakespeare so simple initially. In this case, it really does seem for show. Look, let's take the most difficult work in English that's, you know, arguably barely in English and turn it into the most simple kind of English. I don't know that they're actually aiming at classroom instruction, but more it's an advertisement for basic English. Look what it can do.
And just finally, Emily, Virginia Woolf didn't think anyone was listening to her when she gave this talk.
That's right.
I was trying to find it in your piece. She said she basically she puts in a diary.
Everything is the same. Everything. Nothing has changed. The world remains unchanged.
What was she expecting? Yeah. Was she expecting someone to write her a letter? I was wonderful broadcasting, Virginia, or something like that.
It's very funny. I don't know what she expected, but she hadn't broadcast. This is 37, and her previous broadcast was in 29. So it's been some time since she's broadcast, and I would think the rise that the BBC had greater power and reach over the course of those years. So maybe she thought that by broadcasting in 37, it had some greater sway than it used to have.
She didn't get it anyway. She didn't get
she said to herself, never again.
She didn't get the reaction she wanted.
She felt sort of pinched and made to dance and sing. She was not in her element.
Well, it's a great joy, and we'll listen a bit more of it afterwards, Emily. But it's one of those figures where if you haven't heard Virginia Woolf speak, I think you'd want to hear her talk. And as you said, if this is what she sounded like, so much the better. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
I'm not surprised. It's not the most barnstorming of pieces of rhetoric, is it? I mean, if you were listening to her, I don't know if people were sitting in their kitchens, you know, listening to Radio 4.
I can imagine there would have been a certain amount of confusion. But it is, in a way, it is what you would perhaps expect someone like Virginia Woolf to say about language. These words that you can't rely on them, you can't subdue them, they're tricksy and they change. And, you know, that was how she perceived the world, is, you know, however many facets of other thing.
It just seems hard to think how it was. I mean, I know it is framed very clearly in the series, but listening to it, I don't know what you'd be expected to do with it as a listener.
I imagine that, and I haven't listened to the other talks in it or read them because I think they were reprinted in The Listener after they'd aired. But I think if you listen to it in the context of the series, you would probably get a different impression of it, because if you look at the three speakers who went before, it's then very clear that her talk was a real reaction against that kind of male Victorian pinning down of words and mastering of the language. And she was just saying, I'm the master of nobody. We aren't the master of this language, which is exactly what language is. You can't master it.
No, and I just think it's because that's such a good way of summarising it. And yet she speaks in this, because it is that period, this curiously emotionless...
Yeah, incredibly stilted. I mean, it did make me think that she must have read the BBC's Guide to Pronunciation at the time. It made me feel like I should have a copy. As erstwhile or otherwise pronunciation guru,
in fact, that's right.
Someone should issue me with that.
You are not
that.
RP, though, because you're Northern.
I'm RP on some words and
we
not
are,
on
we
others.
We are very flat vowels. This is like the flat vowel club. You know, we massacre the English language.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I certainly do. We're very provincial sounding, aren't we? Everything's flat. I mean, the BBC would not be happy, I don't think. Virginia Woolf...
You're on the BBC, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Well,
I'm still waiting for the call.
They occasionally have to allow minorities in, I think. And I'm classed in that regard. Virginia Woolf, would Virginia Woolf like this podcast is a question to which there is only one answer. Oh dear. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Zan van Tulleken, Emily Copley, Nicholas Streeton, and of course, the ghost of Virginia Woolf. Do go to the-tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of the TLS, which has all sorts of comic book delights. A wonderful piece on the short stories of Jean Rhys and a very odd theory about the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. And while you are there, you can also now explore our 111-year-old archive, which is chock full of Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
Who actually wrote for us really regularly.
She started on our paper.
We made her. We're taking responsibility. we're taking the credit for that. You can tweet this podcast at @FBFM_podcast with your comments and suggestions. And join us next week where we shall be looking at the strange story of book bandits in Timbuktu. We're going to play you out now with Virginia Woolf talking about words. Until next week, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Now, this power of suggestion is one of the most exciting and most mysterious properties of words. Most exciting if you are a person in the habit of using them. Everyone who has ever written a sentence must be conscious or half conscious of it. Words, English words, are full of echoes, memories, associations, naturally. They've been out and about on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing in today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they have contracted so many famous marriages in the past. The splendid word incarnadine, for example, who can use that without remembering multitudinous seas? In the old days, of course, when English was a new language, writers could invent new words and use them. Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation. But we cannot use them, because the English language is old. You cannot use a brand new word in an old language because of the very obvious, yet always mysterious fact that a word is not a single and separate entity. It is part of other words. Indeed, it is not a word until it is part of a sentence. Words belong to each other. Although, of course, only a great poet knows that the word incarnadine belongs to multitudinous seas. To combine new words with old words is fatal to the constitution of the sentence. In order to use new words properly, you would have to invent a whole new language, and that, though no doubt we shall come to it, is not at the moment our business. Our business is to see what we can do with the old English language as it is. How can we combine the old words in new orders, so that they survive, and so that they create beauty, so that they tell the truth? That is the question. And the person who could answer that question would deserve whatever crown of glory the world has to offer. Think what it would mean if you could teach, or if you could learn, the art of writing. Why, every book, every newspaper we pick up would tell the truth, or would create beauty. But there is, it would appear, some obstacle in the way, some hindrance to the teaching of words. For though at this moment at least 100 professors are lecturing on the literature of the past, at least 1,000 critics are reviewing the literature of the present, and hundreds of young men and women are passing examinations in English literature with the utmost credit, still, do we write better? Do we read better than we read and wrote 400 years ago, when we were unlectured, uncriticized, untaught? Is our modern Georgian literature a patch on the Elizabethan? Well, where are we to lay the blame? Not on our professors, not on our reviewers, not on our writers, but on words. It is words that are to blame. They are the wildest, freest, most irresponsible, most unteachable of all things. Of course, you can catch them and sort them and place them in alphabetical order in dictionaries. But words do not live in dictionaries. They live in the mind. If you want proof of this, consider how often, in moments of emotion, when we most need words, we find none. Yet there is a dictionary. There at our disposal are some 500,000 words, all in alphabetical order. But can we use them? No, because words do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind. Look once more at the dictionary. There, beyond a doubt, lie plays more splendid than Antony and Cleopatra, poems lovely on the ode to Nightingale, novels beside which Pride and Prejudice or David Copperfield are the crude bunglings of amateurs. It's only a question of finding the right words and putting them in the right order. We can't do it because they do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind. And how do they live in the mind? Variously and strangely, much as human beings live, ranging hither and thither, falling in love, meeting together. It is true they are much less bound by ceremony and convention than we are. Royal words meet with commoners. English words marry French words, German words, Indian words, Negro words, if they have a fancy. Indeed, the less we inquire into the past of our dear mother English, the better it will be for that lady's reputation, for she has gone a roving fair maid. Thus, to lay down any laws for such irreclaimable vagabonds is worse than useless. A few trifling rules of grammar and spelling is all the constraint we can put on them. All we can say about them as we peer at them over the edge of that deep, dark, and only fitfully illuminated cavern in which they live, the mind, all we can say about them is that they seem to like people to think before they use them and to feel before they use them. But to think and to feel not about them, about something different. They are highly sensitive, easily made self-conscious. They do not like to have their purity or their impurity discussed. If you start a society for pure English, they will show their resentment by starting another for impure English, hence the unnatural violence of much modern speech as a protest against the Puritans. They are highly democratic, too. They believe that one word is as good as another. Uneducated words, as good as educated words. Uncultivated words, as good as cultivated words. There are no ranks or titles in their society. Nor do they like being lifted on the point of a pen and examined separately. They hang together in sentences, paragraphs, sometimes for whole pages at a time. Then they hate being useful. They hate making money. They hate being lectured about in public. In short, they hate anything that stamps them with one meaning or confines them to one attitude, for it is their nature to change. Perhaps that is their most striking peculiarity, their need of change. It is because the truth they try to catch is many-sided, and they convey it by being many-sided, flashing first this way, then that. Thus they mean one thing to one person, another thing to another person. They are unintelligible to one generation, plain as a pikestaff to the next. And it is because of this complexity, this power to mean different things to different people, that they survive. Perhaps, then, one reason why we have no great poet, novelist, or critic writing today is that we refuse to allow words their liberty. We pin them down to one meaning, their useful meaning, the meaning which makes us catch the train, the meaning which makes us pass the examination.